she's asking for, but if you do...
Well, she's asking for us to be, to eliminate their statute from up here because it's, she does not want any inferences ever that they are involved in a criminal proceeding. Isn't that right?
Right.
By inference.
Right.
And we have no problem with that.
Right. Either that or later on in these new proposed amendments, include 144347 and say that subsection 2 of section 2 applies as a public body rather than a criminal proceeding.
Yeah. I remind members, this is a public hearing, so that this is the first chance. I'm not pressing you to, we'll not plan to do a work session on this tonight, but that's...
That's fine.
Thank you. Carl Stecker is here from the Marion County DA's office.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Carl Stecker. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County, and I'm here tonight on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We wanted to endorse the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 273 because they had come and expanded the problematical definition we'd had with the original bill. The original bill had specified that had labeled as criminal a number of proceedings that are generally civil in context, but are prosecuted by public bodies and involve public bodies directly as parties. And consequently, the amendments that appear on the LC 273-2 amendment are important to us, as I believe the previous witnesses have indicated. I just wanted to mention that there is a fiscal impact with respect to criminal cases or quasi-criminal civil type of cases that DAs do handle. And there is generally a appropriation of about $500,000 every biennium from the general fund for the repayment of costs of prosecution. Now, as I understand it, in the course of the last biennium, the counties were asked to share in that match. And the county general fund, basically, general funds throughout the state, have to make up the differential between the state appropriation, ultimately, and the appropriation and what the necessary cost to be borne. That differential was approximately $600,000 this last biennium, so that the counties, in effect, paid $600,000 towards witness fees in predominantly criminal matters, whereas the state appropriation in match was only $500,000.
Yeah, we've now eliminated the criminal matters.
That's correct, and that's so just to get our concern on the record and obviously to state the reasons for our position. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there other persons who'd like to testify on 273? Okay. And I call your attention that we do have a fiscal impact on the state police and the Bureau of Labor and Industries here for your record. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 273.
Just one question.
Senator Brockman.
I know where the Dash 1 amendments came from. Where did the Dash 2s come from? Who is the sponsor of those?
Proponents of the bill, we probably should have identified them.
The Oregon State Bar.
Okay.
Okay. Catherine, what do you have? Actually, for the moment, I do want to, but we missed having, carrying over Senate Bill 496 of the physician patient privilege. I'd like to, at least while we have some here, just hand out the amendments that have been drafted, just so people have them in their files when we take it over. I don't know if the people are here. We'll just get that later then. It's not scheduled to be on the agenda today, and that's a mix up here.
Do you want me to hand out the
amendments? You have them?
Yeah.
I would while we're waiting for Jack to come forward, since this is the last of Catherine's bills on Senate Bill 494. I'm dealing with 496. The committee met this morning in a work session, and we had some offer for amendments. I want to pass them out now. We'll take them up at another time, since it's not scheduled, didn't get carried over on the schedule today. But these are amendments that were offered at the invitation of, I think, Senator Shoemaker, Senator Hill at that point, at least it was Senator Shoemaker, to talk about the civil procedures amendment.
Yes.
Okay.
Catherine, then we are, and we will call Jack. There's Jack. Actually, I think let's take up Senate Bill 861, which is a public hearing work session. Well, Jack gets amendments, et cetera, organized. We just need the sign-up sheet for that. 861 relates to crime victims.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Senate Bill 861 does relate to crime victim compensation. It expands the folks that victim compensation is payable to include survivors of homicide. That language defining survivor is at the top of page 2 of your bill, and on line 11 of page 1, which is actually the language that includes any person who is a survivor of a deceased person. Excuse me. There are no amendments.
Okay, and we have Douglas Bila is here from Multnomah County. Come on up. Give us your name for the record.
My name is Doug Baloof, and I'm the Director of Victims Assistance in the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'd like to thank the Vice Chair for sponsoring this bill and the Chair for giving this bill a hearing. This is a very simple bill, and so it doesn't require me to give you a lot of testimony. Essentially, it makes a modest change in the people who are eligible for crime victims' compensation to include immediate family members of homicide victims. Few victim populations are impacted as greatly as the immediate family members who have lived through the violent death of a loved one. It is something that has been unfortunately missing from the compensation statutes for some time. There is a great need for it. I would say that I understand that Jerry Christensen of the Crime Victims Compensation Board, who is here to testify today, does have an amendment to the bill as it stands, which I have no objection to. I am here representing the Oregon District Attorney Association, as well as the Crime Victims Assistance Network, as well as my own program, and request that the committee give due regard to this bill and to pass it out. I am open for any questions the committee may have concerning this bill.
Other questions? Senator Hill?
Yes, I guess it applies. I guess the thing that's different in a homicide situation is that does need come into this?
Very much so.
The reason that I ask is, of course, mm-hmm. if in a homicide situation, if people are, I would see if someone who's covered, there's life insurance involved, and someone who receives it versus someone who does not have it, the person who doesn't have it would be more in need.
The entire compensation scheme, it's a supplementary fund. So people who already have life insurance or funeral insurance or things of that nature don't receive the benefits of this fund. The reason it's so important to have this population eligible is often this population is already a population which is poor to begin with. Many homicides victims are people who live in poorer neighborhoods, and their families simply can't get access to any kind of resources to deal with the issues that turn on the death of a loved one. The violent nature of a homicide death raises serious and different kinds of trauma and grief that these people have to experience. Not everyone who experiences this, of course, needs the counseling, but there are people who do and who want it, and it is difficult to look them in the eye and say, "You, the state has nothing for you to offer. We cannot help you resolve these problems, provide those resources."
Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Sure.
I'm new to this as a subject. I mean, I was aware in a general nature of it. Can you give me some idea about what it costs, and is it general fund money, or
where does it come from? Do you want
I guess
we have others that will.
We have Jerry Christensen here, who runs the program, and can come on up, Jerry,
fine.
She might answer those questions as well. I think you can go ahead, Douglas, and talk about where the money comes from, but we'll wait for Jerry to find out how much is
the money for the Crime Victims Compensation Program. And part of the money that funds the victims assistance programs around the state comes from what is called the victims assessment penalty. And on felonies and misdemeanors, there is an assessment to a convicted criminal to pay into this fund, and that's where the money comes from.
It's totally funded through that source?
The compensation. I'll let Jerry tell you the other source.
Yes, we don't have a lot of money in there. That's the problem.
Yeah,
when we started out, it was really... to keep it pretty narrow. Jerry, can I make a comment, please? And then we'll get to Senator Hill.
Yes, thank you. I'm Jerry Christensen.
Madam Chair, I misspoke myself. I do have some amendments from the Department of Justice that I'm sure Ms. Christensen will be referring to.
Thank you. Jerry Christensen, Program Director of the Crime Victims Compensation Program for the Department of Justice. The program is funded through several different sources. We do have a general fund appropriation, but 53% of our budget comes from the penalty assessment on convicted persons in Oregon. We also receive federal funds from a similar federal assessment program on persons convicted of federal crimes.
So what's your total budget for a biennium, for the current biennium?
The total allocation.
Yeah, how much money do you have to work with?
Refer to our total revenue for the 85-87 biennium was $2,882,000.
About $3 million.
Right, just under that.
And you say 53% of that comes from
the penalty assessment
fund. The penalty assessment.
34% from state general fund appropriation. 9% okay. Federal funds.
So about $1 million from the state through the 85-87 biennium.
Mm-hmm.
And that's general fund, right?
Correct.
And do you have any estimate of how much that would need to be increased by these amendments?
We don't believe that that would need to be increased at all. The federal funding that we receive yearly is increasing. We will be getting about $200,000 more in the 89-90 year than we did in 88-89.
From the feds?
From the federal funds, yes.
How'd you work that bit of magic? No,
more federal convictions, more assessments are being paid and collected.
See. Oh, I see. So those are assessments, but they're on federal.
Correct.
I see.
And this particular type of counseling is shown to be relatively short-term and an inexpensive therapy, grief counseling for the survivors. So we don't anticipate a very large fiscal impact.
None of these other types of expenses, I guess, would apply to the survivor, would they?
No, we're limiting this to counseling benefits for the survivors.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Hill.
Hey, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just say a couple words. First of all, the current law does not appear to allow a survivor of a deceased victim who is not also a dependent to receive any benefits from this particular program. The law is specific in that any person who was a dependent at the time of the death of the victim may seek benefits, but in many cases, a member of the immediate family may not have been a dependent and therefore would be excluded from services they would otherwise receive. The intent is to broaden the law in a controlled fashion I think that it's already been stated that the survivors of a deceased victim would include the immediate family members, including spouse, or rather it would mean any spouse, parent, grandparent, guardian, sibling, child, or other immediate family member of a deceased victim, and there wouldn't be the test for dependency in order to determine eligibility for the program. The program obviously is limited by available cash. This bill proposes no additional appropriation, so it would have to be managed within the available funding. Hopefully the federal funding would continue to expand. Nevertheless, this is a type of counseling, and the other benefits of the program would greatly benefit some of these people who are survivors who are currently not receiving any benefits under the program. And Madam Chair, if you haven't heard testimony yet, I'm expecting Jerry Christensen.
Jerry's right at the table.
There, Jerry. I hadn't met Jerry before.
And we do have someone else to testify, and we are in a hurry.
Fine.
So,
then you've heard all the testimony, and hope you're...
Yeah, we're also assuming that you are in favor, that you would be supportive of the amendments that are offered by Jerry Christensen.
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Let's call Barbara Stauffer. I pronounce Barbara's name wrong every time. And I don't know, she needs to give me a flashcard that she holds up.
I'm Barbara Steffler, the chairperson of the legislative group for Mothers Against Drunk Driving for the state of Oregon. Since many of the survivors of homicides are from drunk driving crashes and they are the fatalities that we're speaking of, we would like to add our support of this for Senate Bill 861. We hope that you are able to pass it out with a group pass recommendation. And that's a very short testimony.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you very much. Let's give Jack a few minutes to read over the amendments. We're under a tight timeline, so it would be my suggestion that we actually move the amendments and pass out this particular bill. I think it's not. Jack, you have any comments?
Well, the one question I would have for Ms. Christensen, the last amendment that you've made, inserting for each deceased victim on page 3, is that really what you intended? That would read for reasonable counseling expenses for the survivors up to a maximum amount of $10,000 for each deceased victim?
Yes. Excuse me. What we were looking at there is one deceased victim may have 3 or 4 family members who were in need of counseling, but there would be one criminal victimization and one crime victim. And today the limit is $10,000 for mental health counseling per victim. So we did not want to set up a situation where we might have, excuse me, 4 victims or 4 survivors eligible for $10,000 apiece.
All right, I just want to make sure that was clear.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, I would move the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 861 submitted by the Department of Justice dated April 25th. 1989.
Madam Chair, I have a couple of questions. Looking at those amendments, the first one picks up an Oregon resident killed or injured as a result of a crime perpetrated or attempted against that person in another state that doesn't have a reciprocal program. I'm curious about inclusion of the attempted crime, killed or injured in an attempted crime. Does that apply to somebody?
I think you need to come back up again, please.
I don't see anything in the statute dealing with crimes within the state that bring in a attempted crime as opposed to a crime. I'm quite sure how you could be injured in an attempted crime without it being a crime, but that's a different question.
What's the purpose of that amendment?
That amendment is a requirement from the federal Victims of Crime Act to entitle Oregon to continue to get the federal grant funds. And that was created because there are some states in the United States that only compensate their residents in their state. For instance, if a resident of Oregon were in the state of Nevada and were a victim of an assault, Nevada's compensation program would not provide benefits for that person. So at the federal level, to continue to be eligible for the federal funds, they've asked all states to cover their residents in their own state, and if they should be victimized in another state where there is not a reciprocal program, that we would pay for those costs.
Yes, Senator Schumacher, this does not relate exclusively to the homicide situation. This E...
Oh, I understand that.
And that's why the attempted is...
Well, except I don't see any reference to an attempted crime in the statute itself. We talk about a compensable crime.
That
means something. It would be punishable as a crime in the state, so I'm just wondering why we have attempted in there.
I think, Senator Schumacher, you're really talking about if you're injured and it is an attempted crime, you can still be injured.
Yeah, but...
If somebody is attempting to rob a 7-Eleven store and you happen to be out on the street or right in at the entrance and you're a bystander, you can still be... You could be a victim of an attempted crime.
Excuse me.
And I think that's what the feds are really asking you to include as part of this.
And that word attempted is in the statute up on page 2, starting at line 4, where we define victim means a person killed or injured in the state.
Okay, you're right. There it is.
So that does apply.
Okay. You're right. Okay.
We're still on track there?
Yeah, I was just going to.
I have one other
beat me to that.
Question. The Second Amendment you want to add after the word survivors on, or is it line 2 on page 2, the words of a deceased victim. And I guess I'm wondering if that's necessary since survivors is a word of art defined in the statute as essentially a relative of a deceased victim. I'm just wondering if we're just building in a redundancy or if you have some reason.
Again, that language was to identify that we're talking about one victim and one criminal instance.
I think it's appropriate, Senator Schumacher, Senator Hill.
That one can be a dependent without being a member of the immediate family. And I think it's important to retain the existing language that makes dependents eligible for the benefits, as well as the additional language that provides that members of the survivors who are members of the immediate family.
What's that?
Well, it may not, that's not really directly on point to his question, but...
No, my problem is it's really just a drafting point. It's one I'm raising now because LC will probably catch it if we don't. Maybe there's a reason for it, but I don't see the reason.
I think let's not worry about it.
All right. I'm sure I won't worry about it.
According to our counsel here, Jack has looked it over, and if legislative counsel turns up that the amendments that come to us need to be amended, we'll bring it back to committee on Wednesday. Senator Hill has moved the amendments dated
April 25th, 1989,
presented to Justice. From the Department of Justice.
Madam Chair, then I would move Senate Bill 861 as amended to the floor.
Wait, I do that.
No, I have no problem with the amendment.
Okay. Objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay. Now.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 861 as amended to the floor for due pass recommendation.
Senator Hill moves Senate Bill 861 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Discussion. Call the roll, please, Andre.
Aye.
Motion carried. Thank you. Okay. We have people who have come on. Let's see where we are. Senate Bill 130, we've got a number of people who've come on that. Let's take up that is a public hearing as well and a work session.
No, it's just a
public hearing. It's public hearing on Senate Bill 130. Excuse me, I'm reading here. So let's have Frank Cagney. I wouldn't have gotten it, Frank, unless Jack coached me.
I have some materials. The letter itself is only 3 pages, and the rest of the materials are supporting case law for the propositions I'll be mentioning to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Frank Papagni. I'm a deputy district attorney with Lane County and have been since 1976. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association and on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on DUII. I was appointed to the Governor's Advisory Committee first by Governor Attia, and then I was reappointed by Governor Goldschmidt. And during the course of my time as a deputy district attorney, I've handled over 100 fatalities involving people who were under the influence of intoxicants. Senate Bill 130, to give you at least a brief history of why it's even before you, actually commences back in 1979. At that time, there was a House bill that dealt with the breath test refusal, and that was House Bill 2911. I testified back in 1979 regarding that bill, and there was a concern then that it was unconstitutional. I submitted materials back at that time to the subcommittee chairperson, who was Representative David Frohnmayer. That bill was ultimately passed and signed into law July 26, 1979. The reason why that's of any significance today is because at that time there was no bill to allow into evidence the refusal of someone to do field sobriety tests, because those refusals were quite commonly admitted into evidence without any question as to constitutionality. In fact, in 1980, there's a case called State versus Medenbach, which is included among the package of materials that's being handed out to you. Judge Thornton was the judge who dealt with that particular case. It works out that I happened to have argued that case before the Court of Appeals, but the significance of that was that the Court of Appeals back in 1980 indicated that tape-recorded evidence of a defendant's manner of speech and inability to correctly recite the alphabet was not testimonial in nature and did not violate the privilege against self-incrimination. So that was still the law in 1980. In 1984, however, the Court of Appeals changed Medenbach in a case called State versus Green, which also is among the materials that I've given you. In that particular case, the Court of Appeals and petition for review to the Supreme Court was denied, indicated that evidence of a driver's refusal to take field sobriety tests requested by a police officer was inadmissible under the provisions of the state constitution prohibiting self-incrimination where there was no statutory or other legal requirement that the driver take a field sobriety test. So in 1984, Judge Gillette, who wrote the opinion of Green, said at the very end of the decision on page 525 that if there was a statute that said that the refusal could be used in court, that would not violate the Oregon Constitution and would be admissible. There was a subsequent case, which I referred to in my letter, State versus Smith, that questions the continuing validity of Green. However, as Judge McCormick from Linn County will testify when he has an opportunity, Green is still viewed as sufficient law to keep out the defendant's refusal to take a breath, or excuse me, to do field sobriety tests. So that's how the question gets to you today. What has happened now is since 1984, a defendant can who's been interviewed by a police officer. The officer asked him, would you do some field sobriety tests? And he can say no. And that refusal never gets to a jury. To give you an idea of the field sobriety tests, I've also included among the packet of materials 3 DUII interview reports that are prepared, at least in Lane County, to the Eugene Police Department, the Lane County Sheriff's Office, and the Oregon State Police. So you can understand the type of tests that are given. The idea is the simpler the test, the better the test can be to a jury to show that if the person could not do simple tests, the person is probably under the influence. The problem that we're running into, and the reason why this legislation needs to be passed in the view of the Governor's Advisory Committee and the District Attorney's Association, is that we're getting defendants, and it's not the first time person that gets stopped. The first time person who has no prior DUII convictions typically will do the field sobriety test. What we're seeing is the second, third, fourth, fifth time DUII defendants, and again, Judge McCormick can probably give you better insight, but we're seeing these people refuse to do the field sobriety test because, as local DUII defense lawyers have candidly informed the prosecutors, they tell their clients not to do it because the refusal can't be used against them
and you have a gap in the testimony for the prosecution. The problem and the reason why there's good policy to allow this legislation to become law is simply this. The officer takes the stand, gives his reasons for why he believes the defendant to be under the influence. And then when we get to whether the officer gave field sobriety test to the individual, there's a gap. There can be no mention. So the jury looks at the officer, looks at the prosecutor, and they wonder, why didn't you give this guy a fair chance, or this woman a fair chance? Why didn't you give him field sobriety test? I mean, they know the finger-to-nose test or walking a straight line exists. They know saying the alphabet test exists. Most of these jurors have sat on other DUI cases during the course of their jury duty. And so they feel it's been unfair to the defendant not to have been asked to do these tests. Well, the reality, of course, is they were asked and they refused. But there can be no mention of that. This bill allows simply that to occur, that the officer can testify, I asked the individual to do these tests, and the person refused. And that's it. So the jury has an explanation. There's a complete picture given to the jury so that the truth comes out. What the trial is all about is a truth-seeking process. And the jury can evaluate why the person refused. The defendant has a right to take the stand and say, well, I refused because I didn't think the officer would give me fair tests. I refused because I had problems with my knees or ankles. I had a war injury or a football injury.